From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at what economic impact last summer's Republican National Convention had in the city. We'll get a preview of the Summer of Soul Music series.
Sometimes with jazzy or hip-hop, it has sort of a connotation that's just sit back and relax music. No, this is going to be a vibe. You're going to want to dance and really get into it.
Plus, we'll remember Jewel Tice Williams, an LGBTQ plus trailblazer whose legacy includes opening what is now the oldest black-owned disco in America.
I wouldn't change anything because the end result I'm pleased with. And I think I've worked on what it was that I came here for, and that was to help initiate change, not only for myself, but for others, and to, you know, help take care of the planet.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. 1 year ago this week, Milwaukee hosted the Republican National Convention. City officials touted a potential economic windfall. Visit Milwaukee has since released a report claiming the event carried a $321 million economic impact. But this tabulation does not include normal business that was crowded out by the RNC. Instead, it's a tally of what was spent by visitors and the cost of putting on the event. Lake Effect Sam Woods looks into what's in the report.
1 year ago this week, the Pfizer Forum sounded like this.
I raised my right arm, looked at the thousands and thousands of people that were breathlessly waiting, and started shouting, fight, fight, fight.
City officials sounded like this.
There were a lot of people, tens of thousands, that came to Milwaukee, that stayed at our hotels, that ventured into restaurants, that spent money with local vendors, and left a significant amount of money here in our economy.
And some downtown businesses sounded like this.
I know I've read a lot of things where they say there's going to be 50,000 people here. This looks like a weak Admirals game. There's just not a lot of people down here.
When the RNC came to town last year, many had high hopes of an economic windfall as 50,000 visitors were expected to come to Milwaukee, spend money here, and go home to tell everyone what a wonderful place this is to visit. In May, a long-awaited report on economic activity from the event reported a $321 million economic impact, far exceeding the city's goal of $200 million. But there's one piece missing from this analysis: loss of normal business that was crowded out. Greg Pepitone, Associate Director of Tourism Economics, the firm that compiled the report, said this is because the report is meant to measure the economic impact of visitors only, not the totality of economic activity during the week of the RNC.
Our impact study represents what you might consider the gross economic impacts during the RNC. So the analysis doesn't include displacement or losses in spending by visitors that would have come to Milwaukee.
But not all economists see this as the best way to measure economic impact. Victor Matheson, a professor of economics at the College of the Holy Cross, has published his own economic impact of past political conventions, though not one for Milwaukee's RNC specifically. He says these economic impact reports tend to make conventions look like a better economic deal than they really are, because they exclude economic activity that was crowded out by the event.
The regular who's at the bar, who says, man, I'm not coming in this week because it's just too much of a zoo down here. I have to go through police barricades and everything just to get to work. So I'm not going to work. And you're never surveying that person about what they didn't spend that week. The person who was going to come to Milwaukee for a regular vacation, right? Who was going to travel and say, hey, where do you want to visit? Let's go to Milwaukee, see what's there. You don't measure them, right? You are asking people what they did do, but you aren't, for example, asking the person who didn't go to the art museum downtown what they would have spent had they been in Milwaukee that weekend because they weren't there. And the problem is you're missing all of that. And so a lot of these reports are pretty good at the adding and multiplying. They're just very poor at the subtracting.
But before getting into what is not counted, let's examine how the report calculates economic impact. The report breaks down this impact into three categories of direct, indirect, and induced spending. Direct spending refers to spending by visitors during the RNC and spending by vendors to put on the event itself. Examples of this kind of spending would be booking a hotel for the week or what a delegate spends on lunch at a local restaurant. Pepitone said this data comes from sources like the RNC Host Committee, the RNC itself, Milwaukee City Government, Visit Milwaukee, and select businesses, as well as attendance data and lodging data to measure hotel occupancies and short-term rentals like Airbnbs. Pepitone said indirect and induced spending counts the type of spending that is not directly related to the convention, but would not have otherwise occurred if not for the convention. Here is an example of indirect spending.
So, for example, if a visitor goes to a restaurant and they order a meal, that restaurant is going to have to purchase food from a local wholesaler, right? That purchase of food is considered an indirect impact.
Similarly, an induced impact refers to workers spending wages that they earned via the convention.
So someone that's working in one of those direct industries or one of those indirect industries, they're going to earn a wage, spend a portion of that wage in the local economy. And so that's considered an induced impact.
In total, the report claims all of this spending added up to $321 million of economic impact on the local economy. Stepping back from the event itself and looking at overall economic figures for Milwaukee and surrounding counties, the $321 million figure seems to get a bit murkier. According to state tax records, hotel sales were up 42% in Milwaukee County in July 2024 compared to July 2023. But food and drink sales were down 1% and arts and entertainment sales were down 19% in the same time frame. Surrounding counties had similar mixed economic results based on taxable sales, with some industries up compared to the year before and others down. You can find more information on each county's taxable sales records at wuwm.com. This big boost in hotel sales in Milwaukee County compared to drops in restaurant and entertainment industries might suggest that the RNC successfully boosted hotel sales while crowding out normal business in other industries. But Pepitone says when it comes to tourism specifically, he believes it's more likely tourists rescheduled their visits to Milwaukee rather than outright canceling them.
Displaced is a complex term as well, because we have to understand what is that typical leisure traveler going to do? Are they going to cancel their trip to Milwaukee altogether? Or are they rescheduling it for later that summer or earlier that summer or a different time throughout the year?
When comparing June and August 2024 to 2023, it's unclear if this was borne out, as some industries were up and others down. Perhaps 2025 data will reveal visitors rescheduled their trips for the summer after the RNC. But whether or not tourists return in 2025 to boost restaurant and entertainment industries, one thing is clear. Hotels did very well during the RNC. Matheson says this is typical of political conventions.
When we look at hotel revenue, indeed, these events are big for hoteliers. They love having a bunch of people with big, deep bank accounts coming into town and filling up all the hotel rooms. So we typically get about a $20 million boost in hotel sales, but everything else is pretty much flat, right? So again, those hotel folks who come in and spend a lot of money, they displace the regulars, they displace the regular tourists, the regular folks. So we usually don't see a lot of increases in things like, food spending or retail sales or other things like amusement parks or museums that you could go to instead. But we do usually see a big spike in hotels. That's kind of the one thing that always shows up. Otherwise, it's really not a great event for cities besides that.
Stepping even further back, some stress the importance of examining the impact of the RNC in the context of how large the economy is over a given year. Dr. Michael Farrell is an assistant professor of finance at UW-Milwaukee. He notes that the economic impact of political conventions, regardless if it's the DNC or the RNC, can seem bigger than they really are when compared to general economic activity.
I would say that it was a significant event for the hospitality industry. It represents about 7% of the local economic impact for their sector. Outside of this, if we look at the greater Milwaukee area, it's a relatively small number. So a back of the envelope estimate is about 1 day's worth of GDP. That could be a big number or a small number, depending on your perspective.
Before beginning his research on the economic impact of political conventions more than a decade ago, Matheson measured the economic impact of sporting events. He says the two types of events have similar economic impact stories, but carry one key difference.
Most of the evidence suggests that if you host a Super Bowl, if you host an NBA or Major League Baseball All-Star game, if you get to play in the NBA Finals like the Bucks did a few years ago, the evidence really is that it's not going to make your city rich, but it's likely to make you happy because these are fun events that most of the population can get behind. The problem with a political convention is there's just no evidence of a feel-good effect here either, right? Because you've got a Republican convention in deep blue Milwaukee County, and even if it was a Democratic convention in Milwaukee, you know, we know that half of the state's red rather than blue. So we can all, bleed green and gold for the PAC, but you don't bleed red for the Republicans necessarily. And so this is not something that has that same sort of feel-good effect that you might be left with with other types of major events. So again, just because major events don't make you rich doesn't mean you shouldn't do them. People enjoy watching fireworks, even though a fireworks show does not make Milwaukee richer. Unfortunately, this is something where there's probably not a lot of feel-good effect that occurs either.
That piece was produced by Leg Effect Sam Woods. You can read more at wuwm.com. Tyrese West grew up in Racine, where his family had lived for generations. At 18 years old, he was the spitting image of his father. He loved riding his bike for long stretches, especially to visit friends, which is what he was doing in the early morning hours of June 15, 2019. West was stopped by Mount Pleasant Patrol Sergeant Eric Giese for allegedly not having a light on his bike. Tyrese ran, and when Sergeant Giese caught up with the teen, he shot him twice in the head. What happened in the lead-up and aftermath of Tyrese's death is the subject of a new documentary called Cycle. The film premiered earlier this year at the Milwaukee Film Festival and will be showing at Park High School in Racine this Saturday. Ahead of that, co-directors William Howell and Laura Diane Kesman join Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Kesman begins by explaining what happened on the day Tyrese died.
On the morning of June 15th, 2019, which also happened to be the morning of Racine's Juneteenth Day celebration, Tyrese West was spotted by Sergeant Eric Giese of the Mount Pleasant Police Department, and he was riding alone. The officer spotted him, and allegedly, Tyrese did not have a light on his bicycle, and that was the pretext that he put on his squad lights and attempted to pull him over. Tyrese started pedaling a bit faster, and after Sergeant Eric Giese called it in to dispatch, within 90 seconds of that call, shots were fired, and Tyrese was left with two bullet holes in his forehead. That happened at approximately 1:33 a.m., and it took about 16 to 17 hours for the family, Monique West, and Tyrese's siblings to be notified that Tyrese was deceased. In between Tyrese being killed and the family being notified, he was misidentified by the Mount Pleasant and Racine police departments, and they informed the wrong family that their son was murdered. And after that happened, it still took about 12 hours for the news to be delivered in person on the doorstep of Monique West. What is significant to note about what was happening during those 12 hours is there was a very large community celebration honoring NBA All-Star Caron Butler, who is one of the most notable successes from Racine. and Racine's Juneteenth Day celebration. So those two very significant events were happening during the silence of Monique not knowing where her son was.
Yeah. One of the things, one of the decisions that Tyrese's mother made was to, I don't know if I want to say publicize, but essentially publish the photo of her son's injuries. What was behind that decision?
I mean, when you growing up, you're going to have that talk with your kids regardless. Like every young African-American kid has to learn about slavery. And so I remember those conversations with my mother. When you're thinking about this, it's like basically the same thing. It was just like when we learned about Emmett Till. And when you've seen what happened to Emmett Till, as gruesome as it was, it stuck with you. And you always just wonder, like, what did he do so wrong that could cause that kind of pain? You know, and so for me, I think that's what triggered Monique in that moment, thinking about Emmett Till and thinking about just the fact that she wanted everybody to know, like, this is something that I can't hide, because if I hide this, then, like, who else does it happen to? Like, who's next?
Yeah, Monique said very clearly to us when we were doing that initial interview with her that the first thing that went through her mind after she came to terms with what had happened to her son, like the extent of it, the first thing that crossed her mind was Emmett Till, and she wanted the world to see what this man had done to her son. Tyrese is an example of this broader cycle of police violence that is well documented and well known, that goes back decades, generations, centuries in this country. And so casually, you know, Tyrese just was sort of swept under the rug, you know, by a lot of local press here. And even though, you know, he is an example of maybe the most, you know, extreme version of this type of police violence and abuse of power, it was still so easy for his name to get buried and to not become a hashtag and to not become viral. Tyrese represents all of the names that we don't know, and how many other cases like Tyrese's, you know, happen with such regularity and become so easy to be swept under the rug, essentially.
Well, and that seems to be a big part of this conversation. There wasn't the kind of evidence that seems to push these stories into the news. The photo is pretty clear. He was shot twice in the head. The story that was given by the police officer was very contradictory, and there didn't seem to be much reason for him to pursue Tyrese. How has that lack of video footage beyond the story given by the police, how has that impacted what has ultimately happened in this?
Mm. I mean, to me, that's what makes a better film. Like, just like with George Floyd, like, I don't think the interest in the film is high because I know exactly how this ends. I know exactly what happens because I've seen it. With Tyrese, like you, it's such a shock effect there. Not only because the story and the inconsistencies in how this happened, but because you're looking at a kid.
Yeah, and one thing that I think makes Cycle unique in its genre, if you want to call it that, in terms of, you know, films about these types of incidents, is the fact that we gained exclusive access to the filmed deposition of the officer. And you make an important point that, yes, all of these contradictions became very, very clear in the officer's testimony, given the fact that he was the only other person on the scene except for Tyrese. He was the highest ranking officer on patrol that evening. He had a canine with him in the car, not a partner. And so when he pulled him over, the only two people on the scene was Sergeant Eric Giese and Tyrese West. That's it. And so the remaining narrative, given the fact that his dash cam didn't work, allegedly, and his body cam was not turned on, and all of the surrounding surveillance footage in this business park did not capture the incident. And he happened to be wearing a dispatch radio that required it to be manually pressed, you know, in order for his transmission to be received by dispatch. And so there are all these gaps. And so the only thing that you have remaining is the officer's testimony. And that is the thing that the district attorney uses to qualify whether or not this is a case that she is going to press charges or not. And ultimately, to no surprise, she didn't. So the West family, after District Attorney Patricia Hansen did not file charges, they filed their own federal civil suit. And at that time, we had already started filming. We developed our own working relationship with those attorneys, and we suggested, would it be possible to hire a court videographer for you to film Sergeant Eric Giese's deposition? And so they did that, but that is not typically done.
It's interesting watching the deposition, which you're able to do in the film. Even under just a small amount of scrutiny, Sergeant Giese, who I should say is still a sergeant, pretty quickly contradicts his entire rationale for shooting Tyrese. He makes it clear that Tyrese was pinned to the ground. He had his foot on his arm, so he wasn't able to move it. The person interviewing him goes, well, then how would he have been able to reach the gun, essentially? And it really paints a picture of what this likely looked like. But it seems like even with his statement contradicting, you know, his supposed reason for being afraid, because there wasn't other footage, it doesn't seem to have meant much to those who might hold him accountable.
Absolutely. It not only didn't mean much, but I don't think that those gaps in the logic of his testimony were even flagged for the people doing the investigation initially. There wasn't much thought put into the logic of what happened. He was given the benefit of the doubt really without any scrutiny in terms of, you know, the sequence of events that led to him making the decision to kill Tyrese. You can see the officer's face. You can see the look on his face when he is challenged in that way. And his logic kind of breaks down in that moment. And I think that's very obvious for the viewer.
When you think about the documentary as it is now, what do you hope people take away from it? What do you want them to remember?
Only God can deliver somebody into your life that is capable of creating something this powerful from our pain. And so first you have to have enough faith to be able to accept something, even if it didn't come in the form that you expected.
Yeah, and for me, when the film started, it was driven by so much pain and so much rage and so much momentum to change something, which was all so valid and is the thing that really fueled a lot of those early years. And then, I mean, it took me almost 4 years to edit this. And during those stretches, there were a lot of moments of isolation, and you look out the window and the signs, you know, the Black Lives Matter signs come off the windows and the streets are quiet, and you know that these incidents are still happening with just as much regularity, but it is harder and harder to keep people's attention. And so a fear set in that, you know, are people even going to care anymore when this comes out? And, you know, the words that you hear Will speak from the beginning of the film to the end were written years apart. And what he delivered was something that I don't think either of us could have, you know, sat down. If we thought of it as like writing a script, there's no way we could have come up with what he ended up giving us. It changed the dynamic and was so authentic to how the film started, which is like, you know, you can feel the like the emotion and the rage and everything that carried this film to a point. And then all of a sudden it ends with this proclamation of love and understanding, and is an invitation for people to take all of that emotion and recognize that the cycles that we have control of breaking are the ones within ourselves first and foremost, and that we as individuals are not capable of like fundamentally shifting a whole system. You know, that it starts within ourselves.
Laura Diane Kesman and William Howell are the co-directors of Cycle, a documentary about the death of Tyrese West. There will be a showing of the documentary this Saturday at 1 o'clock in the John Burns Theater at Park High School in Racine. Howell and Kesman spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Did you know that you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen to us on demand. An LGBTQ+ trailblazer who opened the oldest black-owned disco in America has passed away. We'll learn about the life and work of Jewel Tice Williams in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll listen to some music and get a feel of what the Summer of Soul concert series is all about. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Do you like R&B or funk, or how about Latin jazz or hip-hop? It could be time to check out Milwaukee's Summer of Soul. It's an outdoor concert series in its second year at the Marcus Center's Peck Pavilion. It's happening every other Wednesday this summer, including tomorrow night. You may have heard the preview about the first performance on Lake Effect 2 weeks ago. This week, WUWM's Mayon Silver has a preview of the remainder of the series.
Diggable Planets, that's Wednesday, July 16th. They are an iconic hip-hop trio from the 90s. We've got Ishmael Butterfly Butler, Mariana Ladybug Mecca Vieira, Craig Doodlebug Irving, and it's a fusion of jazz, rap, Afrofuturist, cool. And here we've got the rebirth of Slick. You can definitely not walk over that one. Dude, so good. The frickin' bass line. Oh my God.
This song comes out in, I think, November 1992. Think about everything that comes after that. The jazzy hip-hop motif has been such an important styling within hip-hop, right? And it's funny because there are young people that I would think wouldn't be into Diggable at all, right? Because they came out in the early 90s, and that song resonates with them, right? And the reason why I say it's so important is because there's elements, the bass line, the melodies that are used in so many different aspects of hip-hop. Even artists that you wouldn't think of as jazzy or avant-garde still use elements of that in their music. We beat to rap, what key beat to lock, but I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that. And Diggable brought it to the forefront, and it was a really important time because it's at a moment where spoken word is becoming a big part of the hip hop scene, right? Spoken word poets. And also neo-soul. So all of this is converging at the same time, and they just, when you talk about hitting the lottery, right, that is an all-time great song. Heard of it and put it to his hands. What I just flipped, let borders get
loose. How to consume all the beaches like juice. If it's the There's two other tracks that I wanted to play for you. We've got Jettin', it sounds like this. And we've got Doggett. I mean,
that's so good.
Yeah, it's so good. Okay, so what do you think? Like, have you ever seen them in concert? And like, how cool is it that people in Milwaukee get to go see them perform live?
Well, I've never seen them. And that's also the fun part of my job. I get to book acts that that I also want to see. I have reverence for. Like Domino, Brooklyn, no keep it rocking till the sun shows. I pop my junk, my junk, I pop my junk, my junk. And it's interesting because if you're a fan of like A Tribe Called Quest, or Gangsta, or just There are so many hip-hop groups around this time. The Roots, right? They're all merging around this time. Diggable, Arrested Development, I'll throw them in there. Diggable really has a sound that references, right? Like, so many groups that you might have loved, you can hear through Diggable. And so it's not only really cool, really relaxing music, but they are also really good performers. And so sometimes with jazzy or hip hop, we'll have this, it has sort of a connotation that's just sit back and relax music. No, this is going to be a vibe. You're going to want to really, you're going to want to dance and really get into it.
Yeah, when the beat drops, it's just, you got to go with it.
Yeah.
You got to just ride that.
Yeah. Get with the rhythms while you get in with the planets.
Vibe off the jams, but don't take them for granted. And then moving down the trajectory, you've got Soul Unplugged Downtown, yeah. A poet and community organizer who's bringing his hit performance down there, Music, Culture, and Community, Wednesday, July 30th. I want to jump to Wednesday, August 13th. You've invited Madison McFerrin, Grace Weber, DJ Gemini Gilly, and McFerrin is a genre-bending jazz artist, the daughter of jazz icon Bobby McFerrin, and she's forged her own identity with a unique fusion of soul, jazz, and electronic elements. Try and listen. I might not know what to say. Would you describe her as alt soul?
Yeah. You know what's funny? I don't always love some of the
labels.
Terms. Right, but yes, for that's maybe a good way to say it.
This is Lake Effect. I'm WWM's Mayan Silver. I'm speaking with Gerard Blank of Culture by Design. Okay, so here's her track called Try. But no sacrifice comes without mistakes. That's smooth.
Yeah. I like Madison McFerrin. She was actually the last artist I booked. And she had been on my list of artists I was really interested in. She's a national artist, but she's also an artist that a lot of people I'll be introducing them to her. So she checks some boxes for me. And I think that could possibly be one of our biggest nights because we have basically dual headliners. And then bringing on Gemini Gilly. She was DJing at an event we were having. And I was like, I like what you do. And I think you would be the perfect fit. So we were not looking. I know you look at it and you say we have three women performers. We were not looking at creating a night, to be honest. It kind of just came about that way. But that's a part of what we do, is trying to find the balance, making sure we have so many different diverse voices. Yeah, I think people are going to be really pleasantly surprised by Madison.
This is another track for Madison. It's called Outre Lux. But this one is like super innovative. I love this. What's your take?
That's a joint I would put on. Oh man, you're driving down, you know what I mean? You're driving down the expressway, it's late at night, it's just one of those grooves that's enchanting. 'Cause I don't wanna play this game again. And again, like I love the idea of that gives you something different from what Diggable's gonna give you, different from Bilal, but it feels all connected, right? Nothing feels like, oh wow, where'd this come from? And I really like you. You should check out Madison's Tiny Desk. It's really good. And again, she's just one of those performers that I think in the next few years really could break out. And that's the cool thing is, I want people, you know, if she becomes this huge star, I want people to be like, I saw her at Summer of Soul, right?
Definitely, 100%. We were here first.
Yeah.
Okay, the last day of the concert series is Wednesday, August 27th. You've got Milwaukee Salsa legends, Septeto Charambo. You've got some other Milwaukee favorites that day, Gego Inoni and DJ Kenny Perez. Charambo is a word that came to life by combining two different names of rhythms from the Caribbean, one called charanga and the other bomba. And here's a track that's being performed by Septeto Charambo at Zocalo on an earlier occasion. This is from their website. So this is what you'll catch the last night of Summer of Soul. Okay, so you've got some just super classic salsa there, just amazing rhythms, very danceable.
Oh, yeah, well, that was the idea. So this night is very much Latin flavored. We want to keep that as sort of a tradition. Maybe every summer so we end with a Latin themed night, and it's all about come down. Now, this is one where you need to be ready to go, right? Get your dancing shoes on.
That is fantastic. So we've got all this music. Every night is a vibe. How are you planning to pack up your schedule so that you can attend every single one of these? What's your advice to people?
I wish we could send a calendar invite to everybody. But seriously, mark it down on your calendar. Like, go in your phone right now. Wednesday, July 16th, 30th, August 13th, and 27th. Don't book anything else. Just reserve it. Block off 5 hours. Your besties, get them together and come have a great time.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Gerard, for talking to us about this amazing concert series.
Thank you.
That was WUWM's Mayon Silver speaking with Gerard Blanks, the co-owner and managing director at Culture by Design. The next Summer of Soul concert is tomorrow evening at the Marcus Center's Peck Pavilion. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk underway, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area that you've always wondered about at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll remember the legacy of Jule Tice Williams, founder of the oldest black-owned disco in America. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Jule Tice Williams was an LGBTQ+ trailblazer whose legacy includes the opening of Jule's Catch One in Los Angeles in 1973. Tice Williams was the first black lesbian to own a bar in this country, and for four decades, the Catch was a place for all people to come together, and more importantly, be accepted. Tice Williams passed away last week at the age of 86. To help share her legacy, we're revisiting a conversation I had with Jule, filmmaker C. Fitz, and performer Thea Austin when they came to Milwaukee touring with the documentary Jule's Catch One. We hear first from the film's director, C. Fitz, who begins by explaining how Jule and the Catch One caught her attention.
I met her six and a half years ago, 2010. I volunteered to do a short piece on her, 2-3 minutes, because she was being honored for her community service. And as I initially researched her before I met her, I was like, wow, this is a lot. And by the time I did meet her in April 2010, I was just shaking my head saying, I don't know how I'm going to fit all of this into 2 to 3 minutes. We need to do a documentary on you. And she agreed. And as I researched it even more, just the massive amounts of community service, all that she built, not only Catch One, but the vegan restaurant at the time, the clinic when she was 56 that she started, the Village Health Foundation. There's just so much to cover, and it was hard putting it into 84 minutes.
Exactly. Now, Jule, documentaries are a very timely process. They're the span of, I assume, at least months, maybe a year or
more.
It
took me six years.
6 years.
Six
so
years.
Getting to know
very patient.
Over, this whole thing over 6 years, why did you agree to take part in this project?
Well, I welcomed the fact that Fitz wanted to do it. And not only did she want to do it, but initially she financed it, she shot it, she narrated it. She was really involved in it, and how could I not? With someone wanting to really tell your story, feel like, well, maybe there is some importance to it. And little did I know that genius director-producer had crossed my path and was going to be not only doing the documentary for me, but become lifelong friends and associates, too. And that was an added bonus.
Were you both nervous about anything at all?
Nervous about the volume of life, of service, of what she created, and trying to fit it into one film. And over the years, we collected such beautiful interviews, not only from patrons, but patients and celebrities, and it just kept growing. And the archival photos and footage and research, just that made me nervous because her life is so huge and it's undocumented. And it was my job to do a good job in telling the world about her voice that stood up against hate and racism and homophobia. So I was definitely nervous, but I'm happy with it.
Well, and that is such an important thing, to document these places and the people who support and run them. And it's been over 40 years or more that the Catch One has meant so much to not only patrons and friends, but the LGBT community, and then more importantly, the Black LGBT community. It really was the first place in LA for the Black gay community to go. So throughout all of it, what has the club meant for you, Jewel?
Well, it, needless to say, changed my life because I grew up, for 42 of my 77 years, this was a everyday thing of eating, drinking, sleeping, and living it. I was very, very involved in it. And as a result, I grew, with it. And you'll see, or whomever sees the film will note that there were a lot of challenges and obstacles and transformations, just changing of ideas and thoughts about a lot of things that occurred with me, in addition to coming into a place where I liked me. And that, came along with years and years of various kinds of help, of work, of change, of recovery, of spirituality, and the list goes on, and all of those contributed to who I am today. And at the end of our interviewing for the documentary, Fitz asked me the question, what would you change about your life, And there were some pretty horrendous things that happened over the years from early childhood on. And I was able to respond honestly that I wouldn't change anything because that end result I'm pleased with. And I think I've worked on what it was that I came here for, and that was to help initiate change, not only for myself but for others, and to, help take care of the planet in a beneficial way.
Now, you yourself are the heart and soul, organs, blood, everything that kept this club running. But Thea, for you as a performer side of it, what are some of your favorite memories of performing at the Catch, and what made this space different compared to other venues that you've been?
Jewel's Catch One was an amazing place for people to celebrate life, celebrate music. She had the best DJ, they played the best music, and everyone was welcome. Although it was established by Jewel for herself and the Black, lesbian, and gay community, it morphed beyond, I'm sure, what her initial dream was. She was providing a place of refuge for the community to be free, to celebrate life. For me to be welcome there, it represented a space of just high celebration in life, a place of non-discrimination. And that's what it was for me initially. My friend DJ Wayne Williams brought me there, and we were both just patrons supporting Joel's business. And eventually after Rhythm as a Dancer came out and I was welcomed by Joel to perform there several times over the course of the 90s. And in the new millennium, I went to Joel as a patient to the Village Healthcare Foundation. Everything this lady does works. and you know, my heart is in it. And I know my heart's in the right place for, you know, supporting her and her club from the very beginning. There was always, for me, always goodness in it from the time I stepped into her club into this moment in NPR. Thank you for your question.
Absolutely. Yeah. Jewel, the club has, as you mentioned, gone through many transformations and many obstacles, especially at the beginning, with everything from police intimidation, arrests, arson, taking a couple of years to open up after that, the bureaucracy from the city, all the things that tried to keep the Catch closed. So throughout all of that, what was the source of your perseverance?
I would say that it was the spiritual connection, and then having parents that were dedicated to the success of their children, maybe not in terms of financial, but they wanted us all, and there were seven of us, to be educated, at least get our high school diplomas. And they never gave up, you know, at a time from very, 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 very humble beginnings to still every day push the possibility of hope and possibilities of achieving something, of making something out of yourself that they didn't have access to in their time and place, but they wanted it for us. And the way that they stood up, you know, my dad was a union representative at his job for the 35 years or so that he was there. And I didn't even know about it. I didn't know because he was real passive with my mom, especially. And then when I heard that he was out, you know, leading the union and marching against all of the things that we're talking about, you know, the racism and that and discrimination with the elderly because they wanted him to retire before his time. And even though, you know, when I was a kid, might not have been aware of all of these things, the residue of it stayed with me, I think, from them just being tenacious and never giving up and would not let us give up under any circumstance.
Now, with that hard work that goes into running and operating a club, you also have the other side of the patrons that come into the club every night that keep the money flowing and keep it going. But when you're struggling to reopen, after the fire, you mentioned that, quote, it was a gay issue for the black people, and then it was a black and gay and female issue for the broader community. Do you find this true still today?
Sure, there's some of that exists, but for sure, also, there's been change, and there's been growth, and there's been an increase of compassion when we see the news and we see Black Lives Matter, and we see Asians and Hispanics and blacks and whites. The millennium kids are on it, you know. So the change has filtered down to them and broadened to the fact to indicate that it's real and it's really a part of a lot of young kids, whereas before their parents maybe did not feel the same way that they did. And of course their grandparents for sure almost did not feel the same. So we have a lovely mixture.
Now, Fitz, as you've been involved in this project and getting insight into Jewel's life and the life of the Catch itself, what lessons did you learn from Jewel and what she's built?
That patience, tenacity, and perseverance pays off. I don't know how she stood up by herself to everything that she did and kept going. After being burned down, after the city wouldn't give her permits, just roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. And she just kept figuring out how to open that club, open the doors on a tiny budget, and then also simultaneously build organizations like the AIDS Minority Project, because that's what was desperately needed for her community right then and there, and Ruse House, the shelter for women with AIDS and their kids. She just kept opening the doors and kept building. And so It's patience and perseverance, just like my documentary, 6 years. I never thought it would take 6 years. It's a perfect, in my mind, testament to her life so far. And, you know, we could make a mini series out of it. The hardest thing was letting some of the footage go and drop to the edit floor, for sure. But it took a while to do it properly and hang in there, just like she did for her community, and keep making it right, making it better, making the film better, a better history lesson that's never been written before. So, yeah, patience and perseverance.
That was Jules Catch One director C. Fitz, performer Thea Austin, and Jewel Tice Williams from our interview that first aired in 2017. Tice Williams passed away on July 7th at the age of 86. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Milwaukee is known for its beer and brewing industry, but some breweries have been closing around the city. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn why and get an outlook for the future. Plus, we'll speak with Wisconsin's newest poet laureate. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.